Welcome to The Wildlife, a program that probes the mysteries of the animal world through interviews with scientists and other wildlife investigators. I'm Laurel Nemi, your host for The Wildlife, and also author of Animal Investigators, How the World's First Wildlife Forensic Lab is Solving Crimes and Saving Endangered Species. Today on The Wildlife, I'll talk about the impacts of the marine aquarium trade in Hawaii with dive master and activist Renee Umberger. But first, let me play you today's creature call. This week's creature call comes from what is considered to be Hawaii's only native land mammal. Now listen carefully and see if you can guess what it is. At the end of the show, I'll play these sounds again and tell you what kind of animal made them. Now, let me turn to my conversation about the marine aquarium trade in Hawaii and its impacts with dive master and activist Renee Umberger. The colorful fish in tropical fish tanks fascinate and mesmerize many of us. However, we rarely stop to consider what those fish might have gone through to get there. While the 2003 movie Finding Nemo, about a clownfish from the Great Barrier Reef, who was captured for a fish tank in a dentist's office, gave us some hints. The true dangers are much worse. Every year, 30 million fish are plucked from their coral reef homes for use in the aquarium hobby, with over 1,500 species targeted. Nearly all of them, 98% of these saltwater aquarium animals, are wild-caught, as captive breeding is difficult, if not impossible. The Hawaiian Islands are a key source of reef fish for the aquarium trade. Because of its isolation, Hawaii boasts many endemic species, meaning found only there, that are desired in the trade. Species like the Potter's Angelfish or Hawaiian Cleaner Wrasse. However, over the last 20 years, the state has seen declines of 14 to 97% of aquarium fish species outside of protected areas. Millions of Hawaii's reef animals are collected annually, although nobody knows exactly how many because collection reports are not always filed and none are verified against the actual catch. In fact, experts estimate the true catch may be 2 to 5 times higher than the 500,000 to 1 million fish reported that are caught each year. In addition to not knowing the number of fish collected, cumulative mortality rates are not known, although could be astronomical. Many fish die in the collection and transport process. According to Robert Fenner, a leading industry expert, 99% of animals taken for the marine aquarium trade survive less than a year in captivity. Compare that to life expectancy in the wild, where 20 to 30-year-old yellow tangs, one of the most popular Hawaiian reef fish collected for the trade, are commonly found. Today I'll talk with Renee Umberger, who advocates for the wildlife taken from reefs. She has logged over 10,000 scuba dives as a scuba instructor and dive guide on Maui since 1983. Her concern for Hawaii's coral reefs led her to develop projects to address impacts to these fragile ecosystems. These include partnering with marine tourism, conservationists, and educators to create interpretive materials and environmental standards for marine tour operators, which have since been adopted statewide. She's also developed and organized, in partnerships with local fishing supply stores and the NOAA Hawaii Marine Debris Action Plan, underwater cleanups that have removed and partially recycled over 4,000 pounds of fishing gear from entangled corals along heavily fished shoreline sites. In recent years, her work has focused on educating Hawaii's communities and leaders on the impacts of the aquarium trade and advocating for strong protections for Hawaii's coral reef wildlife. When we spoke, I asked Renee how she first got interested in the ocean.
Well, when I moved to Hawaii in 1981 and had the sudden realization that I was surrounded by it, rather than living, you know, inland in California, I realized that I should make friends with it. And so I learned to scuba dive, within a couple years of moving here, and just fell in love within... I have to say, within minutes of being underwater, fell in love with the marine life.
And so is that scuba diving what made you start to get interested in the marine aquarium trade?
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing is that you know, when I would travel to the mainland or anywhere, see tanks filled with fish, you know, you look at the fish, they're pretty, they're swimming around, you know, often they're kind of faded and their fins look a little ripped, and you think, oh, that one's not doing so well. But it wasn't until I started diving and learning about Hawaii species that I would go and look at these tanks, especially on the mainland, and be able to recognize that, wow, that fish came from Hawaii, right? Because, you know, about 25% of our species are endemic. They're found nowhere else in the world. So when I would see an endemic species like a Potter's Angel, which is a very commonly collected fish, I knew where it came from. And I'd seen it in the water, and I knew what its life could be like, right? And so then it just touched my heart, and I felt terrible, really felt awful for these animals that I knew were not thriving in that environment.
So can you describe a Potter's Angel fish, just so that listeners can have a sense of this? Because probably we've all seen one in a tank somewhere.
Sure, yeah, they're gorgeous. Potter's Angel fishes are... I don't know, they're probably a couple of inches long. The front of their faces are a beautiful orange color tapering back to purple. It's those beautiful bright colors that make them very desirable to aquarists.
And in Hawaii, how many fish, different species are there?
Several hundreds reef species, right? This is very low compared to what you would see elsewhere as you move into the Coral Triangle, right? Reefs there.
And the Coral Triangle is in the Philippines.
The Philippines, Indonesia, that whole area. We're talking about, you know, 1,500, 2,000, 2,500 species of reef fishes. Compared to, you know, 300 to 500 in Hawaii.
But what makes those 300 to 500 reef fish species so special in Hawaii?
Well, because many of them are endemic, right? Because we are so isolated, possibly the most isolated landmass on the planet, right? So our isolation allowed the animals that arrived here to transform over time and become endemic species, so that they adapted and got these unique characteristics, making them different. And there are two, in fact, that are so unique that they're called relics. And a relic is a fish or an animal that has doesn't even have a distant cousin anywhere that remotely resembles it. That's how unique it is. And one of them, actually, both of them are highly sought after by the trade. One of them is, you know, if they find them, they sell these animals for, you know, $5,000 each.
Oh, what are those two species? That's interesting.
The blue-striped butterfly fish is the relic that is common on some reefs in Hawaii. It's a beautiful bright yellow butterfly fish with beautiful neon blue stripes. And the masked angelfish is the one that is so rare, and mostly that's because it's found in the Northwest Hawaiian Islands and in deeper water. Now, I've been fortunate enough to see two down here in the main Hawaiian Islands. I have probably, you know, a little over 10,000 dives since I started diving in the early 80s, and in those dives have... there was a short period of time where there were resident masked angelfishes living at a dive site that I went to.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was very cool.
And why are they so sought after by the trade? Because they're rare? Or because
probably.
They're...
Both, right? Beautiful and rare.
So tell me about the marine aquarium trade. You know, what exactly is it?
The marine aquarium trade... in Hawaii and worldwide is what's happening is that fish are being collected. Fish and invertebrates, right, shrimps and crabs and those kinds of things, are collected from coral reefs for use in the aquarium hobby worldwide. And The reason that they're collected rather than cultured is because it's almost impossible to culture them. The technology just does not exist yet to be able to do that. So where 98% of freshwater species, people who have their freshwater tanks, can, you know, rest assured that, okay, 98% of those were raised in a farm. They weren't taken from the wild. And the exact opposite is true for the marine animals, right? So 98% are wild caught.
So 98% are wild caught. That's And how big is the market? How big is that trade?
Well, it's estimated that there are 1.5 to 2 million hobbyists at saltwater aquariums worldwide. And to supply those hobbyists, there are anywhere from, I've seen estimates ranging from 20 million to 30 million fish collected internationally, globally, every year to supply that hobby. And from Hawaii, we're talking about, you know, it ranges, what's reported ranges anywhere from 500,000 to 600,000 to over 1 million animals a year. But the estimates are that, well, it, probably the true number is, you know, anywhere from 2 to 5 times higher than what's reported. So we're talking about a lot of animals taken from our reefs to supply relatively few number of hobby tanks.
And so when you say hobby tank, that could be, you know, what you see in your dentist's office or a restaurant or in an individual's home, that sort of thing?
Yeah, exactly.
And so what is the reporting requirements? You know, when someone collects a fish from the reef, how do they have to report it?
They do. In Hawaii, they have to file a monthly report showing how many animals they took, which animals they took, where they, you know, where they collected them, and not only how many they collected, but how many they sold. And the difference is supposed to be, well, probably some of them died, so or maybe you gave a few away, but most collectors are selling them because that's what they're in the business, you know, that's how they make their money. So there is a little bit of a way to document how many are dying while they're in the collector's possession.
And do you need a permit to become a collector?
Yes. Yes. So you have to, first of all, you have to have a permit to collect aquarium species. And that's regardless of whether you're doing it commercially or recreationally, because the permit is issued for the type of net. People use these fine mesh nets to collect these fish, and it's illegal to use that net unless you're collecting aquarium species, so you cannot collect food fish. So you have to have a permit for that, and then on top of that, you have to have a $50 permit to sell the fish. So the state issues these permits. It's $50. You can get one in 2 minutes online. And it gives the aquarium collectors access to every non-protected reef in the state of Hawaii and has no limits on the number of species that can be taken. So literally, collectors can go into a coral reef and take every living animal off that reef legally.
For $50?
For $50 a year.
Wow, so there's no limits on the either the numbers or the types of species?
There are three species that are listed that cannot be taken, baby goat fishes, some baby food fishes that are very popular, but and they aren't species that typically would be targeted anyway by the trade. The only other limit on the species would be if, you know, if the state says, you know, if there's a size limit for fishers, you know, if you want to take this particular tang, you have to take them, you know, only the ones larger than 5 inches. That also applies to the aquarium trade. And so typically not too many of those animals will be taken because most animals in the aquarium trade are taken when they're babies. So anywhere from, you know, generally the 2 to 4 inches is the size they prefer. But other than that, there are no limits.
So what is being collected? You had mentioned, you know, the reef fish and invertebrates and mm-hmm. corals as well. Could you sort of list what's being collected and traded?
Sure. No corals are being taken. Corals are fully protected in the state of Hawaii. You're not even allowed to accidentally break coral or touch coral in the state of Hawaii. Same is true for live rock. So that would be a rock that has anything that even appears to be living that's on it. So the state protected that years ago, but the fishes and the invertebrates are not protected. So they're being collected probably altogether about 300 different species of fishes and invertebrates are being collected.
What's the top species being collected?
The number one collected fish is the yellow tang. This is a fish that probably everyone recognizes because virtually every image you see of a tank has a yellow tang in it, right? This beautiful, bright, vivid, solid yellow fish. That's the number one collected fish in the state. After that comes hermit crabs. Hermit crabs were very, very heavily collected in the past decade before suddenly they stopped. And that's a concern that the numbers dropped so suddenly.
They were stopped. People stopped collecting them because the fad ended or because there were no hermit crabs to collect?
The fad has not ended. In fact, it's growing. The shift in the home hobby is to reef tanks instead of fish tanks. And so people who are trying to keep corals alive in their tanks fill their tanks with cleaners, right? So hermit crabs, shrimps, these animals are the cleaners on the reef, and so there has become a growing demand for these animals. In fact, millions are taken from Florida's reefs. Biologists recently said that those reefs are crawling to collapse, that it is an unsound fishery because of all the hermits that are being taken and other herbivores. So here in Hawaii, what happened is in the year 2000, there were maybe 45,000 hermit crabs that collectors reported that they took. This is all from the island of Oahu. And within a few years, that number had jumped to 350,000 hermit crabs being reported that they were being collected from these reefs. And the issue with collecting hermit crabs is that their critical habitat is taken. When the crab is taken, right, their shell is taken. And in hermit crab land, when a hermit grows, it needs to, as you know, move into a larger shell, right? So it abandons its shell, leaving the smaller shell for younger, smaller hermit crabs. And when they die, the shell is abandoned and left for the rest of the population. So it's well known by biologists and fisheries folks that if you take the habitat for these animals, the population is going to crash. And so what happened in 2008, hermit crab numbers went from 300,000 a year down to 80,000 a year being taken, 70,000 a year being taken. And the collectors said, yeah, the demand is gone. There's just not a demand for them anymore on the mainland. But my concern and the concern of hermit crab experts is that they have crashed. The populations have crashed.
And has there been a population census of hermit crabs?
No.
Because when you're mentioning these numbers, you're really talking about the numbers collected and not the populations.
Right. It's the numbers collected and it's the numbers that are reported, right? Again, the number that's reported is never compared with what's actually taken. No one's out there counting. No one's out there checking when the boats come in and saying, oh, okay, you say that you took this many. Let's see how many you actually have. That doesn't happen. Funding is not there. The state of Hawaii ranks 48th in the country for funding spent on fish and wildlife management. We're talking about less than $5 million a year is spent on this huge department. So there's no funding for monitoring, there's no funding for enforcement, there's no funding for management, and that's a big part of the problem. So recently the state estimated that to do a population study per species would take about $200,000 and 7 months. Per species. 7 months, $200,000. They don't have the money. And they also just don't really have the incentive to do it. We operate, we appear to operate under this old belief that the ocean is, that it's unlimited. It's almost like the blinders are on. People don't realize that there's no such thing as an unlimited fishery. Fisheries collapse. We see it all the time. We see it happen everywhere. But these animals are treated, this fishery is treated like it's not a problem.
So can you tell me about some of the impact of the trade, both on specific species and on the reef? So you were just talking about hermit crabs and both the impact related on the species of hermit crabs, but also on the impact on the reef since they're cleaners. Are there other species that are taken? Let's take yellow tangs, which are the most popular.
Sure. Most of the fish that are taken are surgeon fishes. They're herbivores, right? So their job, if you will, is to keep the algae in check. They feed, you know, almost from sun up to sundown. They're feeding on the algae. And herbivores are essential to coral reef health. In fact, there's one area on Maui that was recently closed as an herbivore enhancement area. So it is now illegal for fishers of any kind to take herbivores because they're trying to see if the coral will come back and how quickly it will come back. Because what happens is when the herbivores are gone, the algae takes over and outcompetes the coral. So algae starts taking over and the coral reef actually starts to collapse. It loses its three-dimensionality. So that's a known concern. However, there haven't been any studies conducted to show that the aquarium fishery is causing any of those impacts or causing any harm. On the Big Island, where most of the yellow tangs are taken from, they don't have the algae problem that Maui has. So it's theoretical at this point as to what the potential, what could removing all of these herbivores do, because they're not seeing the coral yet. The coral is not in trouble on the Big Island.
So it changes from island to island. Do the types of fish from taken from island to island also change? You had mentioned that yellow tangs are most populous on the Big Island of Hawaii.
Mm-hmm. It changes a little bit from island to island because some species are naturally more abundant on different islands. But other species that they're taking more so on the Big Island and Oahu, not so much on Maui, are cleaner fishes, for instance, right? Cleaner fishes are very important to coral reef health because and to the health of the animals on the reef because they're cleaning the parasites off of the fishes in the area. One cleaner wrasse may eat, 1,000 parasites in a day. By removing those fishes, the concern is that the parasite load will increase. And what has been shown in other areas is that when you remove cleaner wrasses from a reef within just a period of weeks, both diversity and abundance of fishes is significantly reduced.
Who is really buying these fish, and where are they coming from, and where are they going? For the trade, is it mostly from Hawaii to the mainland, or is it overseas as well?
Most of the animals within the state of Hawaii, most of the animals are taken from the Kona Coast. That's where most of the collectors are. That's where most of the trade is. From there, most of those animals are being shipped to the island of Oahu because the overseas freight is cheaper from there for whatever reason. And reports that I've read have shown that they say, well, yeah, about 50% goes to the mainland U.S., but I've just had a quick look at the Fish and Wildlife export reports, and it looks like about 80% of our animals from Hawaii are actually going to international markets, with over 35% going to Japan. And that's just the records, between 2004 and 2009. So apparently there's a high international demand for these animals.
Can you take me through the process from reef to retail, starting with how the fish are collected?
The fish are collected on reefs from a boat, right? The collectors go out on boats and they drop nets into coral and herd.
And it's those fine mesh nets you were talking about?
These fine mesh fence nets or barrier nets.
And how big are they? What do they look like?
They are a few feet high, 3 to 5 feet high, and they can't be too long, right, because then they'd be unwieldy. They've got floats on the top, little weights on the bottom, little anchor weights on the bottom, and they'll set them in the coral, and in particular, baby yellow tangs, which are what they're typically targeting, live in an endemic type of coral here in Hawaii. It's an endemic type of finger coral. I don't know if you've ever seen finger coral. It sort of looks like kind of bony fingers, reaching up toward the sky. A great protection, right? It affords great protection for these little baby fishes. So they're dropping these nets in this finger coral, and they use these long sticks called tickle sticks. That they will usually work in teams, right? Not just a single collector, but there might be two or three collectors working this area, swimming with tickle sticks, tapping.
So now they're in the water versus on the boat, is that right?
Right. So they're underwater on scuba, using this equipment underwater on scuba. So they've got a limited amount of time, right? Especially at these depths, right? Baby yellow tangs are usually found in the deeper depths, 40, 60 feet. At those depths, these guys maybe are able to get an hour out of their tank. I don't know if you're certified, but the old dive tables gave you a limit of 60 minutes at 60 feet, right? So they don't have a lot of time. So they're working, they're swimming together, they're tapping the reef, herding these fish into these nets. And then they handpick them or they use hand nets to pull the ones they want out of this fence net. And from there, they put them in buckets that are going to be raised up to the surface. Now, you can't take a fish straight up to the surface without herding it, right? They suffer from decompression sickness, similar to how people do, except that what happens with fish is that the air expands in their swim bladder. So the fish will either be slowly taken to the surface. We're talking about a yellow tang, a small 3-inch yellow tang, brought to the surface from 40 feet. That would take about an hour to get it up safely. What most collectors do, however, because they just don't want to spend the time is money, they go ahead and they bring these animals up to the surface, and once they're at the surface, they do something called needling, where they use a hypodermic needle, they insert it in the swim bladder, and vent the air from there. So the fish are then, after they've been needled, and they're done working for the day, they take them back to their back to land where They may be held based on whether the collector is also a wholesaler themselves, right? They may be a distributor, or they'll be dropped off at a wholesaler's facility, and they'll be watched at that facility closely for a few days because there's a very high mortality rate that occurs within that first initial period, right? Because the fish have been traumatized, they've been chased, they've been stressed. During the first few hours of capture, they are releasing a tremendous amount of, they're defecating and urinating a lot that first few hours. And if they're sitting in the water that is fouled for even a short period of time, it hurts them, it stresses them, they can die from it. So they're watching them to see which ones are now going to survive being needled, being captured. You know, how clean was the water?
So how many do survive, both, both even getting to the wholesaler facility and then at that wholesaler facility? Are there any studies on how many survive?
No studies, only what the collectors report. It's all anecdotal and what the collectors actually say happened. And it's about 1% is what the collectors are willing to admit that die while in their possession. So that's just that first stage, that first link in the chain of custody. It's about 1%. Then when they're at the wholesalers, at that level before they're actually shipped, it's about 0 to 2% die at that stage. That this is Hawaii numbers. It's not a formal study was conducted. This was from interviews with wholesalers. So 0 to 2% die at that level, and then they're shipped, right? And when they're shipped, there's a DOA rate, a dead on arrival rate. Standard in the industry is just to go ahead and allow 5% to die, to arrive dead. That's not to say that that less or more. The average from Hawaii, I'm told, is 0 to 3%. 5% is acceptable. However, many shipments are much higher than that. And what these wholesalers will do is they'll try and teach the mainland wholesaler or importer will try and teach the Hawaii wholesaler or shipper how to ship these animals in a better way so that they get that dead-on-arrival rate down to 5% or below.
And how are they shipped? I can't imagine it's very easy to ship fish.
Right? It's not easy to ship fish. They are, first of all, standard practice here in Hawaii and probably elsewhere is to starve the fish. So the fish are not fed in that wholesaler's facility, especially if they're going to be shipped right away. Small fish, the industry best practices say you can starve these small fish for up to 4 or 5 days without doing permanent damage to their digestive system. So, but the fish are starved, then they are packed in plastic bags, and the plastic bag is filled with oxygen. And from the bags, they're packed in boxes, and then they're taken to the airport where they may sit for hours, you know, at both ends, right? Both mm-hmm. shipping and receiving.
And there's water in the plastic bags, too.
Water. There's salt water in the plastic bags. Yeah. Based on, and it's based on the size of the fish.
And there would be one per plastic bag or a bunch in a plastic bag?
Typically, there's supposed to be one per plastic bag. But there may actually be situations where there are more.
So then they're in these plastic bags and they get put in a box or a cooler or something to be shipped?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And then how long does it take to go from Hawaii to wherever they end up?
Well, from if they're going to the U.S. mainland, a lot of them are going through L.A. Los Angeles is like the hub. It has a number of huge wholesalers there. They're receiving fish from all over the world, right? So the flight from Hawaii to Los Angeles is, what, about 5 hours?
Yeah.
So they're going to those wholesalers there where the fish are either going to be put in the wholesaler's facility and held for a few days, acclimated, you know, fed, right? Because at that point, maybe they haven't been fed in 5 to 10 days based on the size of the fish. And then that wholesaler is going to then ship them out across the country or to Europe based on orders they're receiving. They also sometimes are transshipped. Transshipping is what happens when the fish are just kind of like they're just given a water change. You know, they just, okay, let's change this water out, clean it up, and put some more oxygen in the bag, pack them up, and send them forward. And that obviously results in a much higher mortality rate on the receiving end.
Do you know how much higher?
No. No, there are no specifics on that. There's just the acknowledgement of the higher mortalities associated with it.
So then eventually it gets to a retailer. After mm-hmm. that, I would assume, after it goes mm-hmm. from the wholesaler to wherever it's going, it mm-hmm. gets to the retailer. Mm-hmm. And what happens there? By that point, how many have died out of 10 fish?
At a minimum, 10, they all could have died, right?
Mm-hmm.
There are entire shipments of fish that are lost. The further the destination from the origin, the more that arrive dead. I mean, there's reports of entire shipments of fish arriving dead. It happens all the time. Certainly you're going to be looking at 5%, 10%, 40%. It all depends.
Okay.
That's right. That's the tough thing. That's the tough thing with it. There have been no studies. It's just what these different groups report. But what the trade reports, if you look at what the wholesalers and the retailers on the mainland are reporting, they're saying that they acknowledge that 1 in 10 fish taken from the reef make it to the retailer. And that's not just Hawaii, right? We're talking about the fish that come from Indonesia and the Philippines as well. So it's hard to know how Hawaii's fish are really doing.
But certainly it's a minimum of 1 in 10,
mm-hmm.
and not a maximum.
Right. Right.
And then
what happens at the retailer?
At the retailer, they're dying while at the retailer as well, right? So the retailers report about 6 to 20% a month are dying there. So
6 to 20% are dying at the retailer.
Yeah. 6 to 20% are dying at the retailer.
And why is that? Just from the stress of all the travel or bad
care? It's cumulative. Yes. The stressors that these animals undergo are cumulative. Studies have shown that the stress from being bagged and shipped, well, starved, bagged, and shipped, produce very high mortalities, even higher than if the fish was just exposed to cyanide, right? Fish that are caught in the Philippines and Indonesia, many of them are caught using cyanide. And this study showed that, yeah, those fish are going to be stressed out from the cyanide, but more fish are dying just from the stressors of being starved, bagged, and shipped. And they're cumulative. So one wholesaler reported that if he kept those fish for 6 weeks, typically they would be keeping these fish for less than 2 weeks, a wholesaler would. If he kept them for 6 weeks, he was experiencing these sudden overnight die-offs. In particular, this was happening with angelfishes. Potter's angelfish from Hawaii is one of them. He called it post-traumatic shipping disorder, where it fish that were eating, they appeared to be doing just fine, suddenly, boom, died overnight at about 6 weeks. So the stressors add up, and the fish die at the retailer or in someone's home tank. The problem is that when the person gets them in their home tank, they think that the fish died because it was something that they did, right? My temperature was off. I didn't have the chemical balance right. One of the tank mates beat up on it and ate it. I mean, there's any number of things that's happening. But when these fish leave the retailer, in many cases, they're not given any kind of stay alive guarantee, right? You walk out the door with that fish, and it's, you know, it's up to you. If it dies, they're not going to do anything. However, many retailers know when a fish walks, when a fish leaves, the fish doesn't walk out the door. When a person walks out the door with this fish, they know that that fish has 1 to 2 months, maybe max, that it's going to live no matter how hard these people try. So a 40-year industry veteran, Robert Fenner, he's written a book that aquarists, for some aquarists, they call it like the Bible, you know, the hobby's Bible, the conscientious marine aquarist. Robert Fenner estimates that 97 to 99% of these, of all animals collected from the wild, are dead within a year. So most of these fish in these hobbyist tanks are dying really within months. And there are plenty of reports of fish that are living longer, right? Experienced hobbyists will have more luck. But it is definitely acknowledged within the trade that especially with beginner hobbyists, most hobbyists are beginners, by the way. Mr. Fenner also wrote that most hobbyists are in and out of the hobby within a year.
Really?
So they're all going to be beginners. They've given up, right? Another report that came out of Hong Kong said, well, beginners are people who've been in the hobby for less than 2 years. But the industry says that, yeah, beginners kill a lot of fish. In fact, one expert wrote that death rates are astronomical. And
why do beginners kill more fish? How difficult is it to have an aquarium?
It's incredibly difficult. It's incredibly difficult because you're creating an artificial environment. This isn't like, you know, for mammals or birds where they breathe air just like we do, right? These saltwater fish are living in artificially created environments, which is exceptionally difficult to do. I've never done it, so I can't speak from experience. I can only speak from, you know, what I read, what I hear, what I see. Very, very difficult to get the chemical balance right and everything else right. So the other thing that's happening is that beginners, many hobbyists are buying fish based on what they look like. They're beautiful. Oh, I want that one. I want that beautiful purple and yellow cleaner wrasse. And I don't care that it's probably going to die. It's going to starve to death within, you know, just a few weeks. Maybe I'll get lucky. Same is true for Moorish idols. Moorish idols, most of them are dead within a week or two. And yet they've been shipped from Hawaii by the thousands because people see them and they want them. And what happens is you get these species, A, that are completely unsuitable. No one can keep them, hardly anyone can keep them alive. B, they aren't good fits for the other tank mates, right? So fish actually eat each other in these tanks or get beat up on and die.
So the combination of fish within a tank isn't that well thought out.
Right, not at all.
For beginner hobbyists, the death rate, the mortality rate is much higher?
It is much higher, but again, most hobbyists are beginners. So this one report out of Hong Kong said that the shortest time that a fish stayed alive for both beginners and experienced people was a week, and that experienced hobbyists were able to keep fish alive. The longest times reported were anywhere from 1 to 8 years. That they were able to keep a fish alive. And that's probably true for experienced people around the world, and that's part of the problem. because one person or a handful of people will have experience keeping a fish alive. For instance, a Moorish idol, some people have been able to keep them alive for 5, 7, 10 years. But the vast majority of these fish are dying, at least according to one report, within a week or two. But that gives people the impression that it can be done, and so they keep trying.
And then what happens once they die? Are they just replaced?
Increasing? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Right? They're just replaced.
So that...
They're just tossed out like flowers. I mean, literally, it's like, you know, decorative flowers. Okay, that bunch died. Better go get some more. Now, that's not for everyone, right? Not everyone is that cavalier about it, but certainly many people are. Some people love their fish. They say, I love my fish. I love these fish. I would never do anything to hurt these fish. But they have no idea what they're really doing. And I think just one thing I want to add here that is really the critical piece to how long they live in captivity is how long could they be living in the wild? Right? The issue is that, right? Yellow tangs, it was only discovered recently that yellow tangs can live to be 40, 41 years old.
Many, 40 to 41 years old?
Yeah.
And in captivity, you're talking less than a year often.
Right. And when we look to public aquariums, like, for instance, the Waikiki Aquarium, they have a list of long-lived animals at their aquarium. Yellow tang does not show up on that list anywhere. So, and they were listing animals that had survived for at least 13 years. There was not a single yellow tang on that list. So, you know, the thing to keep in mind is that, so yeah, they may live to 40, but many of them are also able to survive to be in their 20s and 30s. The average age on one particular protected reef in Hawaii was 11 years old. If the average age is 11 in the wild, certainly one would think that the average age should be 11 in captivity if the animals are being given the proper care so that they can survive. But this is just not possible.
Now, most of the time with mammals and whatnot, we see that zoo animals live a lot longer than their counterparts in the wild. Is that right?
Right. That's what I understand. Not the case for these animals. Far from the case. So, but the point here is that that's not what the trade is saying. The collectors, and Robert Fenner in particular, will say that these animals are living longer in captivity than they would in the wild. And we just don't have any evidence for that. The evidence is that 1% of yellow tangs that arrive onto the reef, that make it through that larval stage where they're drifting out in the open ocean, right, and they're being gobbled up, you know, like something like 99.9% of the mortality occurs at that stage, right? Mm-hmm. Then they drop down onto the reef, and they're called recruits at that stage, right? And 1% of those animals that make it onto a coral reef will live to be 5 to 7 years old. So again, you know, the question is, okay, if they're living that long in the wild, shouldn't 1% of them in captivity be living to be 5 to 7?
And how do you tell the age of a fish?
They look at their ear bone, the otolith. So you have to kill them.
Are there any more sustainable ways of collecting fish or shipping fish?
Well, sustainable is an interesting word. And what we see is that populations are in serious decline in Hawaii. The evidence that we have is that the targeted species, the top 20 targeted species, are missing in their numbers you would expect to see them in from the areas where they're being collected. On the Big Island of Hawaii, certain species commonly seen in the 1970s are now rarely seen. Yellow tangs in the areas where they're being collected, their populations just in the last 10 years are down by 45%. And in the last 10 years, up to 35% of the Kona coastline was set aside as no-take areas. So in those no-take areas, populations are rebounding. Yellow tangs have, populations have increased by 57%. Gold ring sturgeon fishes also heavily targeted. Their populations have increased. But other species are continuing to decline, both inside the protected areas and in the open areas. So if you're talking about populations, you're protecting the sustainability of entire populations, clearly you need to set aside much higher areas as no-take areas. 30 to 35% isn't going to do it. You probably have to do something much higher. But the other thing you have to do is, you can't allow unlimited collection in the open areas. It's just going to be, they're going to be collected until they're gone. But that doesn't address what's happening to the animals themselves, right? What is sustainable for the actual animal? Is sustainable for an animal? It's the idea that an animal in captivity should be able to live for a considerable amount of its natural potential. That's one definition that's been given for what a suitable species for the trade is. Only species that are able to survive for a considerable proportion of their natural lifespan should be allowed in the trade. That definition is used.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about none that we know of. No animals are suitable.
I was just about to ask, what species would that be in terms of, are there species that would be better suited or not? And you're saying there wouldn't be any species because right now the care isn't appropriate for them to be able to live a good portion of their natural life.
Right.
Is that right?
And that's right. And there aren't any life history studies, longevity studies in the wild, right, that are going to show us what is the, you know, what is the natural lifespan for most of these species. It's just unknown. The only reason we know for yellow tangs is because they're such a important, quote-unquote, important species for the aquarium trade here that money was spent on a study. You know, the researchers will look at that, but that information doesn't exist for most of the other animals. I don't know of any of them. Right, that's going to show that level of information.
And then if people are interested in this issue, what could they do to inform themselves? Where can they go? How can they help?
My website has information.
And your website is forthefishes.org, which is forthefishes.org.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes, forthefishes.org. You can go there to learn more. Of course, you can do any internet search is going to bring up a lot of information. The Humane Society of the U.S. has some information on it. I think it's important for people to be aware that even if the retailers are saying these animals were farmed, or these animals were caught in a sustainable way, that might not necessarily be the case. So it's really important to do homework. And most importantly, don't buy animals that are wild caught. Do the research, find out, see which animals are being raised in captivity right now. I've got a list on my website, a current list of animals known to be captive bred, but not necessarily commercially available at this point.
So there are some reef fish that are being raised in captivity?
Yes. I think the most common one that people would be aware of would be the commonly called the clown anemone fish, the Finding Nemo fish.
Finding Nemo.
Right?
And how about Dory?
Dory is not. No. Dory is not, and Dory does not do well in captivity. Dory is one of those species that does not do well in captivity.
What kind of species is she?
She's a surgeon fish. She's not from Hawaii. She does not do well in captivity. At least that's what I've read on some of the sites I visited.
So there's a current list of animals on your website that have a greater chance of being captive raised versus wild caught.
Yes.
On the legal front, what could people be doing to lobby their Congress or at their state level?
The most important thing is to let them know that you care, that it's something that you care about, right? So it has to be addressed at a federal level. Of course, in Hawaii, we address it at the state level. We're even able to address it at the county level to try and protect the animals taken from our waters, right? It's our responsibility to care for these animals because they come from here. On the receiving end, if people care about how these animals are being used and what's happening to them, then it is helpful to contact their federal representatives and senators and let them know it's something they care about and ask them to do something to protect these animals from the trade.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your taking the time to talk with me.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation about the impacts of the marine aquarium trade in Hawaii with dive master and activist Renee Umberger. Now, let me play you today's creature call once again and see if you've guessed it correctly. This week's creature call is the sound of what is considered to be Hawaii's only native land mammal. It's the Hawaiian hoary bat. These bats can eat up to 40% of their own body weight in a single meal. One of their favorite foods are moths, and scientists suggest that certain moths in Hawaii have evolved with the bat, and when they hear the bats, the flying moths will defensively dive to elude the hunting bats. Listen to the sound of a Hawaiian hoary bat. Archived episodes of The Wildlife are available on iTunes, at my website, laurelnemi.com, and at laurelnemi.podbean.com. You can stream The Wildlife live at theradiator.org every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And, of course, if you have comments about this show or ideas for future ones, you can email me at laurel@laurelnemi.com.
The Wildlife is generously underwritten by the Lake Champlain Land Trust, a nonprofit organization permanently conserving the lands, lakeshore, critical wildlife habitats, and natural areas of Lake Champlain. More information is available online at lclt.org. This has been The Wildlife. I'm your host, Laurel Nemi, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, in Burlington, Vermont.